Guardian Unlimited.
Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm here to talk to Joyce Carol Oates about her novel The Falls. I got a quote, I hope you don't mind it, from John Updike about, which maybe applies to this novel of actually, The Falls as well, about that sort of sense of kind of variousness and productivity, which I think is distinctive of what Joyce does. And he said that, you probably know this, he said that you're born 100 years too late and needed a lustier audience than we are, apparently. A race of Victorian word eaters, worthy of her astounding productivity, her tireless gift of self-enthrallment. So I don't know if any of you fancy yourself as Victorian word eaters. But there's definitely a sense, I think, in this novel, of a kind of, I don't know, energy and spaciousness that you don't always get in contemporary fiction. And I suppose I wanted to start actually maybe with the title, which is also the place, the location, The Falls, which of course refers to Niagara Falls. And you find out quite a lot. I didn't know much about Niagara Falls, but it's an incidental pleasure of the book. You find out quite a lot about Niagara Falls, both the city and the natural phenomenon in the course of reading it. And there's an epigraph that kind of goes with the titles at the beginning of the book about, and I presume it's from a real Niagara Falls physician's log. That's a real book, is it?
No.
It's an invented one.
It's an invented book.
And it's an invented book which tells us about the sort of hypnotic spell
of this place.
That's right. And how you get to kind of gaze at it in a sort of almost self-destructive fantasy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's, the characters seem obsessed with that as well through the book. I mean, is the self-destructiveness an aspect of what makes the place alluring, do you think?
Well, I was thinking of the falls in many, many ways. Obviously, it has a sort of metaphorical significance. For those of you who believe in symbolism, you know, like the idea of the fall, they fall from Eden, but it is a literal place, and I grew up not far from Niagara Falls. So when I was a little girl, I was taken often to the falls, and I guess you have not been there,
John.
I was getting the sense that you hadn't seen it. It's just sort of relating to it as if it were a symbol. But it's this, this extraordinary, mesmerizing wonder of the world, which is so astonishing. I'm wondering if anyone has actually seen Niagara Falls. Just a few very shy people.
Oh, quite a few.
Oh, more people.
Oh, Guardian audiences.
And who went there on a honeymoon? Oh, nobody. Well,
I think after reading this, you made the right decision.
They went and didn't come back. Maybe that was the case. Well, when I was a little girl, I was basically just so amazed by the physical reality. And we've gone back almost every summer, very frequently, because I have family there. And when I go along the Niagara River, the river itself is just extraordinary. It's very, very turbulent and fast-moving. And for some reason, the highway seems about 3 feet from it. So you're driving along, and suddenly you look over, and there's this extraordinary rushing with white water. And it's often slate blue and very beautiful, and just rushing along. And then the falls itself sends up this mist. In the winter, it sort of freezes into strange Baroque shapes, and it's rather like a fairy tale. It's very magical. In the summer, it's very wet and extraordinary. If you are a writer, there are certain things that you experience that go beyond language, that there really isn't any way to enclose this in language. That's very simple. And so I tried different things in the novel to evoke that sense of the physical reality. Now, though I did make up the quotes, because I couldn't find anything that was quite right. I mean, I did a lot of research, but I couldn't find any almanacs or anything that had quite the right language, so I sort of made it up. But even though I made it up, it is true that there are certain parts of the world you all know about. The Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco is the most, maybe the most famous. Well, some people are compelled to feel that they should die there because it's very beautiful. It's a romantic and mystical possibility of death. You would not throw yourself out of, say, a fourth floor window onto a dirty cement floor of an alley. You know, you just would not do that because it's not romantic, so you don't do that. But you're drawn to this other seeming beauty, and there's a kind of scrim there of the mist, so that you don't grasp the horror when you do hit the water. It's the same thing as that concrete floor of the alley. And in the Niagara Falls, the first chapter begins with somebody who's performing one of these symbolic erasures of the eagle, that it's a very romantic, mystical kind of death. You're just drawn toward it. You stand there, and it's just so mesmerizing, the Horseshoe Falls, and the sound obliterates your own thoughts, and your language sort of disappears, and so you feel what an easy way to die, sort of a Keatsian sense, a very romantic sense. But then in the novel, I show a few chapters later the consequences of this act, which is something very physical when the body is sort of comes up out of the whirlpool, and how physical it is, and how bloated. So there's different meanings of the falls, but the first, the most literal and basic meaning is that it is a physical reality in a geographical place, so you can actually go there. It's not something that's in a novel that's been invented by the novelist. And then because the falls is there, and here I'm repeating what I wrote in my column for The Guardian. The falls is the reality that's the physical given. It's like a Garden of Eden, let's say. It's so extraordinary. But then over here is the city of Niagara Falls. And this is one of these now debased industrial cities of the United States. There's so many of them now that were once very prosperous. In the 1950s, it was they were very proud of the fact in Niagara Falls that they had more chemical factories per square mile than any other city in the world. And it probably is about half or one quarter that size now. These chemical factories, in many cases, have been closed down. And so the distinction between the falls, which is so beautiful, where you almost would be drawn to them, and then the city of Niagara Falls, which is this debased and very horrific industrial city. That's the contrast that really led me to write the novel. Because when I was a little girl, I only knew about the falls, and when I got older, I learned about Love Canal and these environmental disasters that follow as a consequence of chemical manufacturing.
One of the ways in that it's, for a reader who indeed hasn't been to Niagara Falls, so one of the ways in which it's physically present, I suppose, rather than symbolically so, is that right the way through, and I guess you must have been conscious of this, I suppose, there are these, it's as if it, because of the falls and the most sort of the amazing amount of kind of water vapour and the noise of the place, it creates this kind of sense that even in the city nearby, which is doing its own different things, there's a sort of microclimate or something, so that this place shapes people's sense of what it smells like, what it feels like, and you keep, it's as if they keep noticing odd things about their location, which you would never have in any other kind of place.
Right. I wish I could find some other place to write about that was a real place, but also such a powerful metaphor. Because it's because the falls generates the electricity, the electrical power has made the city possible. And the city generated then all these poisons. It's really amazing. You know, as I was saying in my piece for The Guardian, now you can do the research very easily on the internet and just type in the words Love Canal, Niagara Falls, New York, and just read some of these horrific and almost unbelievable documents. And it was so, to me, very touching because a housewife and mother named Lois Gibbs was the woman who got this going in the 1950s. Her children, since she maybe lost a baby to leukemia, and she had had miscarriages, and it was really a grassroots, very touching and poignant democratic activism that began in the neighborhoods. And then she confronted all this hypocrisy and cruel behavior on the part of even doctors who were basically in the pay of the establishment. So it's another of my novels that deals with class warfare or class, the struggle of classes to kind of assert themselves and maybe disenfranchise people trying to make their way up and meeting resistance as they go, but yet still moving up, and then maybe with the next generation moving up.
So was it that one of the central characters, perhaps not the hero is the wrong word, Dirk, who undertakes this kind of legal case, and it seems kind of, I mean, the word doomed is actually used a bit, and it also destroys his family because his wife becomes obsessed with the fact that, wrongly, that he must be having an affair with the woman who's the agitator. I mean, was that sense that actually it's was that kind of doomy narrative shaped by actual events, or by it also seems part of what in a lot of the time in the novel is the character's conviction that things are going to end badly, that they're cursed, that they're damned, that perhaps it's a kind of it's almost a property of kind of family sagas for novels about families across the generations, that you follow those senses of that sort of sense of doom. But was that a version of history, or was that making a shape, a plot that was suitable to the novel?
Well, probably it depends on which character.
I'm just thinking about his, because he fails, he loses all his money pursuing this case.
I think in terms of Araya, she's in a way a kind of gothic heroine. And she's the widow in black, the widow of the falls. And she's this sort of semi-mythological person. But Dirk is an activist lawyer, and he's of a different type. For the first people who were involved in the environmental class action suits, for many of them it was disastrous for their careers. If you were a lawyer, for instance, and wanted to work pro bono for these people, it probably would have been very difficult then to get back into your profession locally. You would be called a commie lawyer, a Jew lawyer. You would be branded in any way that would diminish the worth of what you were doing. This went on for a long time. It began in the late 1950s, and the whole thing wasn't settled until 1978. So there were just almost generations of people involved in the lawsuits. And President Jimmy Carter in 1978 did declare the whole area a disaster area so that there was federal aid available. But all along the line, there was resistance from from local people in power, including the local newspaper, people at the university, local university, professors of biology or earth science or whatever would offer themselves as expert witnesses for the defense was Hooker Chemical. I don't use that name.
But you do use sort of some real names of real companies.
I mix them in, yeah, but the main one I think called Swan, that was really Hooker.
And what about, I mean, the sense that on the one hand there's this kind of, there's this a novel which is about an environmental history and about local politics and municipal corruption. And on the other hand, you've taken, I don't know if you agreed with me, I said you've taken a genre which has a rather low reputation amongst literary connoisseurs, the family saga, where you follow a family's history across the generations. And I was wondering why you look, because you do that in other novels that you've written as well. And I wonder what the kind of, what the sort of attraction and power of that is. Because there's quite a lot of risks, it seems to me, as a novelist involved in doing that.
The most enormous risk is that you might have a bestseller. Well, there are different ways of tackling the idea.
Well, you're right, but lots of bestsellers are family sagas, aren't they?
Oh, yes, yes. Because people actually like to read about them.
Yeah, yeah. So is that one of the reasons that you like to write them too?
Well, there are different ways of looking at a novel. My novels tend to divide into two types. One would be the rather slender, slim novel that moves quite rapidly along one plot line. I see you have Mother Missing here.
Yes.
And that's one of those. And the Tattooed Girl is another of that type. And these novels are readily discernible because they're more slender than the other novels. Then I have the other novels that represent sometimes postmodernist experiments in that kind of novel. I have a novel called Blonde, which is the posthumous life of Norma Jean Baker. Norma Jean is telling her own story. She is the person who becomes Marilyn Monroe. And so it's a very experimental novel that in manuscript form was 1,400 pages. So it's one of these things where you can do lots of things in so many pages that you wouldn't be doing in a short novel. Then I have novellas that are maybe 120 pages, and they all do different things. They have different rhythms. And most obvious difference with the long novel is that you can do quite a few decades. You can start a theme here that, which I often start in a somewhat mythical or operatic way with a heightened language, almost like a fairy tale. Even though it's set in the 1920s here, it could be like 1890 or 1870 or 1700, you know. It's something that's sort of coming out of the past before we were born, and all of us were born. And then as the novel moves on, part two, part three, part four, I might have five parts, the language starts to get more contemporary. The younger people are being born of the older generation. And then these people who are being born move into being our contemporaries. So it's basically, that's something that you can do with a long form. And then you can take an idea from 1925 and see how it develops through the 1930s, 40s, 50s, up until 1978 or whenever. You know, you have a long period of time. You show people changing. You show people who are young here who are now the older people here. It's just much more that you can do. One is not thinking this is a debased form of literature as one sets out. One sets out thinking this is very exciting, and it's a very a large canvas. It's sort of like a movie that's 4 hours long instead of a movie that's 90 minutes
long. But it is true that sort of Barbara Taylor Bradford does it, and
Thomas Mann does it.
Yeah, I know, but I was just, it got me thinking why it is that kind of it's associated. Yeah, okay.
Dickens.
No, I'm with you. I'm suggesting that it's kind of, it's something that once upon a time literary writers were happy to undertake and now is kind of associated, you know, it's only something that kind of popular fiction does.
Well, I don't know that I'm the only one who does it, really. I think, basically, I think of them as postmodernist novels that do a lot of different things.
Because this one has quite a lot of, I don't know, the things you expect to find in family sagas, whether they're by Thomas Mann or John Galsworthy or whatever, they have the sort of the working through of kind of younger generations, as it were, kind of resolving the resentments of older generations. You have financial scandal or sexual secrets. But you also have that thing, which I could call it risky, which definitely happens in The Falls, and which I think is risky and very interesting for that reason, which is that you're really with a central character.
Can I ask you a question, John?
Yeah.
So you're a quintessential reader. Which part of the novel do you think came first? See how your intuition.
Part of the novel came first?
What would you think came first?
Well, obviously, it can't be the opening thing.
It's a scene in the cemetery with Royal and the woman in black.
Oh, well, I did want to... Yeah, sorry.
And it's a scene that I had written. I was so haunted by it. It was so powerful. It must have been a dream or something. I wrote this out in such excitement. And then I thought, well, this is so strange. Who are these people? So then I put it away for like 5 or 6 years. And I would take it out again and read it. And again, this feeling of a kind of otherworldly, shivery sensation. And then again, I would think, well, who are these people and what are they doing? And then I put it away again. This went on for so long. It was just extraordinary. And then after my parents died, and I was thinking back over our family, I wanted to write a novel in which a father was redeemed at the end. A father had seemed had always been loving and really a wonderful father, but had been misunderstood by his wife especially, and not understood at all by his children who didn't know him. And I wanted to write a novel that would have the redemption of the father at the end. And so I thought I would write about the falls. And then I remembered this chapter in the cemetery. I thought, well, this belongs right in there. It's right in there. And it all came together, but in such a strange way. And it seemed to be so wonderful and kind of mysterious. And
well, it's I had wanted to ask you, I was going to ask you about, I suppose, the one of the things which is quite demanding to keep a sense of, if you're a writer, I imagine, in a family saga, which is a plot. And I was going to ask you about this very scene, because it's strange and mysterious, I mean, to the reader as well, because it's...
And to the character.
Well, because it's not as you... I mean, of course, it's exactly as you described, but also it's got that added element that it's the son making love to the woman that the father was being suspected of making love
yes,
to.
Yes, she's the woman in black.
Yes.
People see one another in these cliches, you know, like the woman in black or the widow bride of the falls. But then when you get to know the people, they're basically people like us, you know, and other people are projecting kind of demonic imagery. Like when Dirk gets to know the woman in black, he's been thinking of her as a kind of vulture, and he actually takes her home. She's been standing out in the rain, and she's hitching for a ride. He gets to know her. She's just this nice woman. She's a mother. She loves her children, and he feels so embarrassed and so ashamed that he has demonized her. So I often write about people who are misunderstood in that way.
Because a couple of your reviewers in Britain, who actually admiring reviewers who'd liked the novel, got quite cross about the scene, which you now, I hadn't realised, describe as the sort of genesis or the kernel of it, and were sort of saying, this doesn't belong here. What's this doing here?
Well, many things don't belong. Many things don't belong in a novel like this. I mean, there's things that it's not a naturalistic, very plain realistic novel. Mother missing is a very realistic novel. I mean, there are novels that have certain degrees of realism, and some are more like dreams or surrealism. Araya was very close to my heart because she is somebody who gives piano lessons, and she loves to teach. Even her students are playing these dreadful things, and it sounds terrible, and yet she loves to teach, and there's a certain love of music, and she doesn't. Though she has certain ideals, at the same time she can compromise herself by being this teacher on this level. So I just felt that I really liked her a lot. Other people didn't like her. They thought she was not a good mother.
Well, there is that. She's quite a strange character in that. This is what I suppose I was trying to ask.
She goes into a sort of fugue state where she almost allows her children to drown. You know.
Yes. Well, that's no. Well, that's just what. That's okay. That's
it was just
okay.
One day. Something happened one day. I mean.
I think what maybe readers might find harder is the fact that for so much of the book she's you don't just see it through her eyes, you see it from other points of view as well, but you're very, I would say, intimate with her. You're very, very, very intimate with her. And then because it is a family saga, to put it bluntly, she has to move back. And not only does she have to move back, but she becomes this kind of, well, yeah, gothic maybe is the wrong word, but she becomes this rather slightly monstrous character when you no longer know what's going on inside her head.
Well, she's just just somebody's mother.
I know, but...
No, I don't have these narrow definitions of people. To me, a person can have all sorts of endearing eccentricities, but still be within the range of normality.
But she refuses to tell her children anything about their father.
There have been many women like that. I wrote a novel called We Were the Mulvaneys, which is about a father who banishes his daughter and doesn't see her for many years he's basically dying. And many people have written to me and said, this is my father, you know, and these people who've been banished and treated badly by someone in their family, there are millions of them, and they're perfectly normal people. Some things are not talked about that openly that take place in families, but it often is the case. As I said, I get many letters from people. Somebody in the family has to die, and then all the people who have been estranged, now they come together, and the Christmas that they celebrate after this person dies is a wonderful Christmas because this person's been the impediment. But if you knew all these people, including the person who was the impediment, you'd probably think that they were fairly normal and nice people.
But your novel has to, because it's a novel, it has to have an ending, doesn't it? Where an ending where...
They all come together.
They all come together. Yeah.
That's a kind of novel
that
it is, you know. There are other ways of writing novels where they all go apart.
Yeah, yeah. But it's an ending where, as you, I mean, you're kind of interested in sort of how people become mythical characters. And I was interested when I read the ending. Maybe I was slightly made uneasy, perhaps it was your purpose by the ending, in thinking on the one hand in finding, I don't know, the traditional satisfaction of an ending where people come together, where people maybe understand some things they didn't earlier in the novel. That seems to me something, you know, if it's well done, satisfying that novels do. But on the other hand, they're brought together in this way where the dead father is being made into a sort of, as you say, a mythical character. Which makes you think, well, yeah, but what is this togetherness based on if it's based on sort of flags and statues and...
But it was true. He was very brave. He was a very good father. And he died in the service of this sort of lost cause. He thought it was a lost cause, the environmental lawsuit. And then some years later, it does come to fruition. I hear Ralph Nader making a little appearance. Now, I don't know how you feel about him.
Doesn't he? No. Don't they keep saying he's going to appear?
He's going to come in and cash in on this. But in our country, Ralph Nader... is a villain. He allowed the election of Bush, and I don't want to get into politics here and ruin what has been a perfect contentious discussion already. So I thought I'd bring you Ralph Nader a little bit in like a common who's he learns that this person's going to be honored as an environmental protector, so he thought maybe he'd come and have his picture taken or something, but he doesn't actually show up, I think.
And
I didn't put him in my novel.
And there's the other plot thing that comes at the ending, which allows for the ending, which is that, because everybody here, we presume, has read the novel, so I'm allowed to.
Oh, we don't presume that.
Yeah, no. Well, not, I hope, to spoil anybody's pleasure. There's another important sense of an ending, which is given by the fact that, is it not, that the daughter, Juliet, finds that... And this is quite sort of, again, this is kind of quite dramatic stuff. The man who has saved her from throwing herself, who has grabbed her when she's about to throw herself into the falls, who's this sort of fairly monosyllabic or inarticulate man, but he actually kind of has the sort of, a sort of secret of the plot, doesn't he? Because he knows what happened to her father, because his father was responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of quite a... did you know all the way through that tying together of all those things was going to happen?
Did I know all the way through?
Well, did you...
No, I went out one day and I looked under a toadstool. Oh, my God. This is how my novel's going to end. No, I'm assuming that's a serious question.
Well, I mean, it's a serious question because I'm just...
It's like asking if we got here to London deliberately. We really meant to go to Greenland, but we sort of swerved in this direction. Yes. I was actually awake and conscious when I wrote all the novel.
Okay. Well, that's that's a proper riposte. And perhaps the...
Now, let me ask you a question. Oh, you sound guarded.
Yeah, no, no.
You sound a little wary.
No, ask away. Ask away.
Who would you think would be the novelist's favorite character after the main characters?
The novelist's favorite...
Favorite character.
Favorite character in The Falls.
If you read every page.
I have. I've read every page twice.
I'm just teasing.
Yeah. Favorite character.
Someone's monosyllabic.
Well, it is. It's Bud, is it? Is he's your favourite character?
Stone Crab.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I kind of.
Who does he remind you of? Physically, he's a replica of which very famous boxer?
Very famous boxer. Well, I was going to say he is. There is a
the only boxer I knew. The only one I knew.
Oh, right. I don't know who that is.
Mike Tyson.
Oh, right.
His physical replica, Mike Tyson. But unlike Mike Tyson, he doesn't want to fight, and he's not a very good fighter. He wants to cook. He's a chef. He becomes a chef. I thought it would be so interesting to write about, which I haven't done much of this at all, about men or women, but in this case a man, who actually wants to prepare food and wants to nourish people rather than hurt and hit them. When he's a very little boy, his mother leaves home, and so he's an older brother. He prepares food for the younger children, and he sort of is their nourisher. Then he gets a little older, and he's this physical type, very much like Mike Tyson. And like Tyson, somewhat inarticulate. And he wants to be a chef. And so he's introducing cuisine to a tavern in Niagara Falls. And I thought it would be very funny and very amusing that somebody is introducing romaine lettuce, you know, in Niagara Falls. And people are looking at this and wondering, like, what is this? Oh, they can only deal with iceberg lettuce at the most. And it was meant to be funny. I see that it wasn't. But I liked him a lot. He was very close to my heart.
Okay, well, it's time, beyond time, for me to ask everybody here if they would like to ask Joyce anything.
You said the first scene was the graveyard scene, and then everything came from there. What was the scene, or the what followed that in the book?
What followed that? Well, I wanted to write about a novel in which a father would be redeemed, so it has a kind of arc like this. And I always had for many years wanted to write about Niagara Falls because I grew up nearby, and my own father had died, and some. You know, many things that one can't talk about that go into writing a novel, lots of emotion and sort of inarticulate, unspeakable things that you never can put into language that you can sort of put into a novel. About a man being courageous but being blunt and maybe too outspoken, and he drinks too much and he makes mistakes, but he's a very good man. It's just that everything goes wrong. He's misunderstood. And his wife had loved him so much, but she becomes jealous. And it all kind of went wrong because of the poison of that environment. I didn't see how. Now, in real life, you can lead perfectly happy lives, I think, in the midst of a poison environment. But in a novel or a movie or an opera, there's got to be some sort of porous relationship so that the happiness of the family is undercut. As polluted by the poisonous environment. So then I went back to the beginning about a happy marriage, that they were going to be very happy. And then I went back a little farther, that first she has a typical 1950s marriage. And many of you don't remember 1950s, but there was a certain era where people got married without knowing one another too well. And then they were horrified when they discovered what they'd actually married. The 1950s were the times when even the era when even straight people had not come out. And they just didn't know anything about the opposite sex, and if they knew a little bit, they were kind of frightened, and yet these people got married all the time, and we are the consequences, you know, because they did get married, and it was pre-abortion era and pre-divorce, so they stayed together, and therefore we're here, you know, we sort of look the consequences. So I wanted Arroyo to be of that generation, which was, I think, so much fun to get married to somebody whom you didn't know at all, and then turns out to be completely repulsed by your physical self. And then that's just your wedding night, and then you have the whole rest of your wedding life to look, your married life to look forward to. In a novel, you could just go commit suicide, so this person runs out and commits suicide. This is just preliminary to the happy marriage, where they physically they're very happy with each other and they really love each other. And I thought I would write about a very happy married couple, and they're happy for a while, but then because they're living in this poison element, then they have to move on, I think, to the next stand, the next step, which is being involved in the community. So the husband's involved in the community, and but the wife stays back in the family. That's a good question.
I wanted to ask whether putting this novel along with all the other many of the other things that you've written, that what characterises it for me are sort of three different things, and it's the last thing I'd like you to comment on. It's the interest in gender, which obviously runs through all your novels. It's the interest in class, which I think is very distinctively you. But then there's the anger. And do you need to be angry about something to write this novel and indeed...
That's so interesting. The anger, I would thought, was really dissolved in the novel. I have a lot of sad feelings about my family, my background. I remember my grandfather. He died of emphysema. He had worked in a steel mill in Lackawanna, New York, which is right near Niagara Falls. He was just in his 50s, and workers didn't have any protection in those days. I'm sure many places in the world, and even in the first world, I'm sure they still don't. But you could be a relatively young man, and you get married, and you have a family, and you would basically just sell your health for a paycheck. And there weren't any pensions, and you could try to sue for personal injury. But nobody ever won. Nobody ever won those lawsuits. That's very recent in our criminal justice system. So I was thinking of my grandfather who died so young. His lungs were just bleeding with these little steel filings. I suppose they didn't have proper masks. They didn't give the workers protection. And nobody explained to them how dangerous this was to their health. So I remember that I was about 11 years old when he died, and we were just told it was his time. And I thought he was an old man. And I found out later he was about 53. You know, they would say, oh, well, it was his time, it was his time, you know. And so I was sort of haunted by that. Then my own father had emphysema also, though, because he lived later, he had better health care. And so he lived to be actually about 85. 84, 85, 86, he lived a quite full life. So I have this sort of class anger. Now that I live in Princeton, New Jersey, it seems very ill-placed. It's just so incongruous. But if you are a novelist who've come from a different social level than the one in which you live in, much of what you experience is fraught with a kind of irony. I wouldn't say it was bitter or anything negative. It's just sort of an irony that you're aware of in a way that you would not be aware of it if you're just horizontal and always been on that social level. It's when you come from a lower level and rise up, you know, and you sort of see what it's like in that context. It does fill you with a kind of irony and a sense of melancholy and bittersweet emotions of a kind that go into a novel.
Do you care more about your characters than you care about your readers?
Oh, well, I don't have much sense of my readers. I mean, the readers are likely to be very distant people whom I had never met and can't imagine and would never meet. John Updike once said that we think, or at least he thinks about the readers, and we work very hard to make the sentences, you know, to use punctuation in different ways and to make the sentences very elegant. And the typical reader, says John Updike, is sitting up in bed at night reading and sort of falling asleep and sort of, you know, falling asleep. And then finally just putting the book down and putting the light off, you know, that basically the experience for the reader is so different from the anxiety of the writer that there's certain element of comedy in it.
Which writers have influenced you yourself?
probably about everyone I read, especially up until I was, say, 20 or so. Those early influences are very powerful. I've talked about this before, so if I'm repeating myself, please excuse me. But the first book that it really made a strong impression on me was Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass. I was about 8 or 9 years old. My grandmother gave me this book, and it seemed so big to me. It was the illustrated Alice with those wonderful drawings by John Tenniel, is that his name? Mm. And these line drawings, so dreamlike and kind of eerie and shivery and comical and so imaginative and surreal. And that book just meant so much to me. Here's a little girl, Alice, a girl heroine, and she has all these adventures that are in some cases very frightening. Really horrific. But she's never really afraid. She's never really panicked and terrified the way I would be. And she was a little British girl, and yet she seemed so much like myself. I was a little girl growing up on a farm, and she was a British girl. And with such difference between us, and yet I could really identify with her. And so the whole saga of Alice with these two adventures really, really made a profound impression on me.
Does being a literary critic, I mean professionally, an academic critic, does that influence the writing of fiction?
Well, that's an interesting question. I personally have written thousands of pages of reviews on literary criticism, so it would be hard to be influenced by all of this because it's all contradictory. But when I was quite a young person, when I was in high school, I wanted to be very influenced by Hemingway. I tried to be influenced by Hemingway. You know, Hemingway is this terrific writer. His sentences are so powerful. It's a sense that there's a surface reality that we see with our eyes and with our senses, but then there's a subterranean depth, and that's what's generating that surface, and that's the typical Hemingway momentum, where things are moving forward, but there's a little tug and something from the unconscious. And then the antithetical kind of vision would be Faulkner, where we are not really moving forward. There are plots in Faulkner, but basically everything's over with. It's all over with in Faulkner. It's a sort of static and lyric with the predilection for the past. And the past, your parents and grandparents and your ancestors are sort of acting upon you all the time. In Hemingway, there's very little of a sense of history or past family history, but in Faulkner, that's everything. A character is almost nothing except the sum of what has preceded him. So both those writers had influences on me. I thought when I was an adolescent, they're both wonderful writers. Then when I was a little older, James Joyce, he's the writer's writer. He's just our great mentor. He's just absolutely wonderful writer.
This isn't specifically about the Falls, but what I wanted to ask you was, for someone as prolific as you, can you see sort of times when your language and your use of language has changed through the years? I mean, I'm thinking of novels that are entirely different in the way that they speak, like, for example, Garden of Earthly Delights versus Brokeheart Blues. You know, it's like you just get right under the skin of the way that your characters would speak, and I'm wondering where you get your inspiration for that. Because we've talked a lot tonight about plots and characters,
yes.
And but some writers are quite samey in the way that they write. They put it all together and it sounds, oh, this is a book by so-and-so, because this is the way they use language. But with you, you seem to have this amazing ability to be sort of one person and under the skin of that character and talking the way that character would speak, and yet be someone completely different in another novel with a different subject matter.
Well, thank you. Maybe you are a writer or a poet yourself because you have a good ear, but our speech is all musical and we have a certain rhythms, and it's like our fingerprints are distinctive, so our voice patterns are distinctive. And I love the human voice. So the characters in my novels have certain ways of looking at life, and they think in sentences that are relatively complex or relatively simple, and they have predilections for certain patterns of imagery, let's say, that are particular to them. So the first part of A Garden of Earthly Delights, which is Carlton, Carlton has a simpler rhythm and much more primitive compared to later on in the novel when somebody who's younger, who's more my contemporary, has a different kind of intellectual language. And so too with the falls, it begins, I said, with this sort of mythical, heightened and operatic rhetorical language, and then it gets modulated until we get to somebody like Royal or even Stonecrop, who are younger men living our contemporaries, and so the language changes very much. To me, that's the excitement of writing. Virginia Woolf said that writing is actually very easy. You get the rhythm and you get the voice, and then it's very easy. That actually is a deeply ironic statement, because it isn't easy to get that rhythm. You can get a banal, flat rhythm that isn't very rewarding and that you don't like. You can get something that you've done with the previous novel, but to get a new and distinctive and you hope original rhythm for the new novel, that actually is very difficult, and that's why writers are always doing so much revision and being disappointed and frustrated because they can't find the voice. I know when I found the voice, I can hear it, that it's right, and I can hear when it isn't right, and so I just keep trying and I do things over and over again. I can write a chapter over 20 times, and I know it's not right, and it makes me very unhappy. But I'll keep on doing it till finally I hear it, that it is right, and then I can go on to the next chapter. So thank you for such a good question. Yeah.
I should just say thanks very much to Joyce for coming and talking to us. She'll, anybody who's interested, you'll sign some books if and just say thanks very much for it.
Thank you. That was fun.
Guardian Unlimited.